From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on last week's deadly attack in Paris. Cameroon repels an attack by Boko Haram fighters. We'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak, plus the flight recorders from the crashed Air Asia plane have been found. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A Turkish news agency has aired security camera footage from an Istanbul airport that reportedly shows the girlfriend of a French terror suspect entering the country. 26-year-old is sought by French authorities in connection with a three-day terror spree in Paris last week that left 17 people dead. Meantime, France is deploying more than 10,000 troops across the country by today. Sally Hennessy is following the story.
French Prime Minister Manuel Valls said the country must not let down its guard because the security threat to France is still present. The Prime Minister was speaking to French broadcaster BFM TV.
Le plus haut niveau du plan Vigipirate non seulement est maintenu, mais je veux le dire ici.
He says the highest level of France's terror alert system is being maintained. The 10,000 troops due to be deployed by Tuesday is the first time so many have been deployed in the country. French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve said nearly 5,000 security force troops would be tasked with protecting the country's more than 700 Jewish schools. Sean Gregory is an international securities expert at Britain's Durham University.
The French state right now is most anxious to avoid a repeat of the attacks. I think at this moment, therefore, putting extra troops on the ground, perhaps rolling up a few plots earlier than they would like to have done, that kind of thing, I think, is inevitable.
In London, British Prime Minister David Cameron met with security chiefs Monday and discussed how the attacks in Paris would impact the training of British police and security services. But the terror threat level, which is currently at severe, remains unchanged. Gregory says the troop deployment may prevent attacks in the immediate future, but he says European governments are also reconsidering long-term solutions to tackling terrorism.
There's a great deal of cross-channel cooperation necessary because obviously these days jihadis are very mobile and they take inspiration and training and so on from each other.
Sunday, Minister Cazeneuve said European interior ministers have agreed to boost cooperation to tackle militant attacks. They met shortly before more than 3.5 million people took to the streets in France to show solidarity with the victims of last week's attacks. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Britain's David Cameron, and Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi were among more than 40 world leaders who attended the march alongside French President François Hollande. And around the world, cities hosted their own demonstrations on Sunday. In Washington, around 3,000 people gathered for a silent march. In Australia, several hundred people gathered in Sydney's Martin Place. And in London, major landmarks were lit in the red, white and blue colours of the French flag as more than 1,000 marched through Trafalgar Square. Sayla Hennessy for VOA News, London.
And Washington admitted Monday it erred in not sending a top official to attend the Solidarity rally in France on Sunday. At a news conference, White House spokesperson Josh Earnest backpedaled a bit on the decision to have U.S. Ambassador to France Jane Hartley and the State Department's top diplomat for Europe Victoria Nuland as the highest-ranking American officials to join scores of world leaders alongside French President François Hollande.
I think it's fair to say that we should have sent someone with a higher profile to be there.
Earlier on Monday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry dismissed criticism that neither he nor other top officials traveled to Paris.
I don't think the people of France have any doubt about America's understanding of what happened, about our personal sense of loss, and our deep commitment to the people of France in this moment of trial.
Secretary Kerry added that the U.S. has been deeply engaged and has been sharing intelligence with France since the moment the attack took place. Hackers claiming loyalty to the Islamic State group have compromised the Twitter and YouTube accounts of the United States Central Command, which is leading the fight against the terror group. VOA's Carla Babb has more.
The U.S. Central Command Twitter account on Monday posted messages including, "I love you, ISIS." It removed Central Command's name and replaced it with the name Cyber Caliphate before Twitter suspended the account. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren called the attack a cyber prank.
This is little more than an act than a prank or vandalism. And it's inconvenient and it's an annoyance, but that's all it is.
Follow-up tweets included links to documents that appear to contain the telephone numbers and email addresses of dozens of U.S. military officials. Central Command said that its initial assessment showed no classified information was posted during the attack. Warren said the social media account breach was an issue within YouTube and Twitter and did not actually break into any government networks.
There's no evidence that any DOD system, any DOD computer, any DOD network has in any way been compromised or breached.
Isaac Porsche, a cybersecurity analyst for the RAND Corporation, agreed with Warren and called the attack a public headache.
In terms of sensitivity, these accounts are not supposed to be tied to any sensitive databases. So slightly embarrassing, yes, not quite clear it's damaging.
A CENTCOM official confirmed to VOA that officials had worked with Twitter and YouTube to lock down the accounts. He said it is unclear when they will be reactivated. Based at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida, CENTCOM oversees the U.S.-led air war against the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Cameroon is saying it repelled an attack by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram, whose fighters attacked a military base in the north. Cameroon says its military beat off the attack, nearly killing more than 140 Boko Haram fighters. It happened in Kolofata. One soldier was killed. Meanwhile, Nigeria's military says 150 were killed in clashes with Islamists in the northeastern town of Baga on January the 3rd. A defense spokesperson was responding to media reports of as many as 2,000 killed in the assault on Baga and surrounding villages. One resident says Boko Haram remains in control of Baga and has erected barricades in strategic locations. He describes corpses everywhere. Thousands were forced to flee. At the United Nations, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has issued statements about what he called recent horrific terrorist attacks in Nigeria. Farhan Haq, deputy spokesperson for the Secretary General, spoke to reporters Monday in New York specifically about two attacks in which young girls were strapped with explosives.
The Secretary General utterly condemns this depraved act at the hands of Boko Haram terrorists. The United Nations stands ready to assist the Nigerian government and all affected neighboring states in bringing an end to the violence and to alleviate the suffering of civilians with all available means and resources.
Two explosions ripped through a market in northeastern Nigeria on Sunday. That blast came a day after a bomb strapped to a young girl believed to be just 10 years old detonated at a crowded market in the northeastern city of Maiduguri, killing at least 19 people and wounding 20 others. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State, lies in the heartland of an insurgency by Boko Haram. At the U.S. State Department on Monday, spokesperson Marie Harf was asked for U.S. response to the most recent attacks in northern Nigeria.
We obviously condemn these attacks in the strongest terms. Boko Haram is a huge threat, remains a huge threat. All you have to do is look at what's happened over the last week to know that.
Harf said the U.S. was trying to work with Nigeria despite government's termination in November of a third phase of a training operation involving a Nigerian army battalion. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan is running for re-election in February elections, but it's uncertain how voting can proceed in areas under Boko Haram's influence in the north. Nigeria's homegrown Boko Haram group drew international condemnation when its fighters kidnapped 276 schoolgirls from a boarding school in the northeast town of Chibok last year. Dozens escaped, but 219 remain missing. UN-mediated Libya peace talks aimed at reaching a political solution to end the fighting in that conflict-ridden country are expected to get underway this week at UN headquarters in Geneva. Lisa Schlein reports mediators are urging the warring factions to seize this opportunity to restore stability.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
Armed militias celebrate the capture of Libya's Tripoli International Airport in August. It highlights the ferocity of the fighting among rival factions, which has engulfed the country since the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi's government in 2011. The unity among the warring factions, which succeeded in ousting the country's long-serving dictator, quickly evaporated after his death. Now, two opposing governments and two parliaments, each backed by rival, heavily armed militias, are competing for power. UN spokeswoman Yvette Morris tells VOA the United Nations is hoping to break this deadly logjam.
The UN's special envoy, the Secretary General's envoy for Libya, who is also the head of the United Nations support mission in Libya, Bernardino Leon, hopes that the talks could help to lead to the formation of a unity government that enjoys wide support and pave the way for a stable environment in which a new permanent constitution can be adopted. He's also hoping that the talks will put in place security arrangements that will help to bring an end to the armed hostilities raging in different parts of Libya.
But no date has been set for the talks to begin, although they are expected to get underway later in the week. A round of talks scheduled for December 9th was repeatedly postponed because of intensified fighting between the internationally recognized government and Islamist militias. But the UN support mission in Libya, which is hosting these talks, believes this time the warring factions will stick to their word and meet. UN envoy Leon is calling for the parties to freeze their military operations during talks. He says this will help efforts to restore stability and prevent a further slide toward deeper conflict and economic collapse. He warns the parties not to let this opportunity slip by, as it may be their last best chance for achieving peace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
China has mediated talks between South Sudan's warring factions, winning pledges from the rivals to speed up the country's peace process. China has invested heavily in South Sudan's oil production and has committed combat troops to be a part of the UN peacekeeping force in the country. South Sudan has endured more than a year of fighting between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and those loyal to his former vice president, Riek Machar. Foreign ministers from seven countries and the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, also known as IGAD, have met in the Somali capital for the first time in nearly 25 years. The trade grouping's talks focus on political and security progress made in Somalia, as well as the anticipated 2016 elections. VOA's Abdulaziz Bello has more from Mogadishu.
The high-level session in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, brought together top diplomats from the countries of Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan, and Uganda. Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud welcomed the IGAD delegation and thanked the regional bloc for picking Mogadishu as this year's host capital.
This IGAD Council of Ministers session is significant because it is the first time IGAD member states at this level are discussing Somali political matters inside Somalia.
Security was stepped up in most parts of the city prior and during the meeting. President Mahmoud thanked IGAD member states for assisting in the stabilization of Somalia. Four members of the regional bloc have already contributed troops to the African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM. The 22,000-strong AU force is mandated with assisting the federal government in its war against the terror group Al-Shabaab. Ethiopian Foreign Minister Tedros Adhanom, who is the chairman of the IGAD Council of Ministers, said that the IGAD regional bloc and the international community have both witnessed the progress made by Somalia in the past couple of years and reiterated their commitment to the country's security.
And this is not just recognized by us, by IGAD, as neighboring countries, but also by the international community.
And what's important now is to continue the march toward the sustainable peace and development.
The top UN envoy to Somalia, Ambassador Nicholas Kay, said Mogadishu's successful hosting of the 53rd IGAD summit is a clear indication of progress.
It shows that peace and security is returning to Somalia. It shows that Somalia is returning to the community of nations. It is now able to operate as a full member of IGAD and host IGAD Council of Ministers.
Somali President Mahamud also thanked the international community and paid a special tribute to IGAD.
Following the positive development over the past 2 years, achieved with the support of our international partners, and in particular IGAD member states, we have to continue to work together towards the implementation of the agenda on the federal government of Somalia's political way forward.
An IGAD summit is expected to be held in Mogadishu later in the year. Abdul Aziz Bilal, VOA News, Mogadishu.
World Health Organization says governments flouted their obligations during the Ebola crisis and wants the ability to take more control of global health emergencies in the future. WHO documents presented to the UN agency's executive board are critical of governments that instituted border closures and travel restrictions, as well as their inadequate risk communication and preparedness. Agency is seeking more power to tackle such issues as disease, drought, and other natural catastrophes, such as typhoons. The Ebola epidemic has claimed more than 8,300 lives with more than 21,000 known cases. Some good news in all of this involving British nurse Pauline Cafferkey, who contracted the deadly virus while serving as a volunteer in Sierra Leone. She's been taken off the critical list at a London hospital and appears to be recovering. Meanwhile, American doctor Rick Sacra, who beat Ebola, plans to return to Liberia, where he contracted the disease, to help the overworked colleagues of his at a missionary hospital. International Atomic Energy Agency has announced a new project under their Peaceful Uses Initiative. They say it will provide high-quality training and cutting-edge equipment based on molecular biology to help virologists in 11 African countries more quickly and safely diagnose emerging diseases such as Ebola. The United States has contributed $1 million to help the fund's project. Michel Warneau heads the Africa section of the IAEA's Department of Technical Cooperation. He explains to VOA's Kim Lewis how molecular biology will help doctors diagnose Ebola more quickly.
The techniques supporting and transferring in the member states is called RT-PCR, so it's a reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction. And this technique is amplifying the genetic material of pathogens and allows identifying the virus, for instance, in the case of the Ebola virus.
What type of training will be provided through the funding?
So in this project, we will be training virologists to first use the methodology, so the RT-PCR, to identify pathogen. And in the particular case of this very dangerous zoonotic diseases, so this disease that can be transferred from animals to human, we will be also training them to work in high safety working conditions.
When will the training start and how long does it take?
The project is just starting now. We just received information about the funding of this part of the project, so we are initiating the implementation of the project right now. We'll start by a coordination meeting with a world expert in these molecular biology techniques, and the training will be starting as soon as possible. In fact, they will be discussed during this coordination meeting that by now is planned to be held on the third week of February. So hopefully we could start the trainings in March or April of this year.
I understand there are 11 African countries that will be involved in this project. So what countries are you going to start first?
First, you have to know that this project we're speaking about is a project that is, it's an activity that is proposed under the Peaceful Uses Initiative of the IAEA, but it's only part of our activity. So it's part of a broader project that aims at strengthening the capacity of the African region in detecting emerging zoonotic diseases in wildlife and livestock in order to be able to anticipate the risk of outbreak in the human population. So by now, this first activity is targeting 11 countries that are the countries, let's say, most at risk, either because they are affected by the Ebola virus or because they are bordering these countries or from the road traffic or air traffic. But in a second time, in the broader project, all the African countries are targeted as participating countries.
What type of equipment will be needed and where will this come from?
The type of equipment we are dealing with in this case are RT-PCR machines. So there's machines that allow detecting the DNA, the genetic material of viruses or the pathogens. And these equipment are in fact from companies. Many companies are selling it on the market. And so we are developing some methodologies using this equipment, especially in our joint division between FAO and the IAEA, to diagnose animal disease.
What is the advantage of using molecular biology to diagnose infectious diseases?
These techniques have huge advantage of sensitivity and rapidity. So most of the classical techniques can take several days before you are able to identify a pathogen. And in this case, in using this RT-PCR, we are speaking about a few hours, let's say a half day to identify, to analyze several tens of samples. They are also, by now, at least to the best of my knowledge, the only methodologies that are validated, so in which you can actually identify the virus.
Once this project is completed, how many virologists would you say will be trained and prepared to use the molecular biology equipment?
In the first part of the project, we are targeting, as you said, 11 countries, and in each of these countries, we are planning to have a team of 4 to 5 virologists fully trained to these techniques. In this particular case, of course, because we are dealing here with an emerging zoonotic disease of high risk. So we already have many people because these activities, we are performing them in the countries, in the member states of the IAEA for a long time. So many people are trained by now, but for more less dangerous diseases, let's say.
Michel Warneau heads the Africa section of the IAEA. He spoke from Vienna with VOA's Kim Lewis, who hosts Africa News Tonight.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Divers have now retrieved the voice recorder from the AirAsia jet that crashed into the Java Sea last month, killing 162 people. An Indonesian official says the recorder is on an Indonesian Navy vessel. It's on its way to Jakarta for analysis. Divers brought up the flight data recorder on Monday. There are two recorders in all. Those looking into the crash hope the recorders will give them vital clues into why the jet crashed into the sea on December 28th, when the pilots apparently tried to avoid a storm. One official has said the plane was likely brought down by an explosion caused by a change in air pressure. But the head of an Indonesian subcommittee for air transport is appealing for calm as the investigation takes place.
I urge all experts not to give any theory if they don't have valid data, and please don't make people confused. We urge people to wait and be patient with our ongoing investigations.
And in all, so far, 48 bodies have been recovered from the sea. Authorities hope most of the rest of the victims can be recovered from the several large pieces of wreckage that have been spotted on the ocean floor. Pope Francis has begun a week-long trip to Asia with stops planned for Sri Lanka and the Philippines. Sri Lanka is predominantly Buddhist, but the Catholic Church sees itself as a unifying force in the community because it includes people from both the majority Sinhalese and minority Tamil ethnic groups. The Sinhalese are predominantly Buddhist, while the Tamils are mostly Hindu. On Thursday, the Pope will be traveling to the Philippines, Asia's only majority Roman Catholic nation. Millions of people are expected to attend an outdoor mass given by the Pope. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. You know, if you find yourself on the Internet, check us out there. I'm at Twitter and my address is VOA Norman. That's where the conversation about what's going on around the world is happening. Also, straight ahead, the latest world news coming up. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On January 13, 1832, American novelist Horatio Alger was born. Alger wrote more than 100 novels, mostly about young boys living in poverty and managing to find success and prosperity by working hard and never giving up. Many successful men in the early 20th century claimed Alger's books were important in inspiring them in their early years. In 1842, Dr. William Brighton, a doctor serving with the British East India Company Army during the First Anglo-Afghan War, became famous for being the only person to reach safety in Jalalabad. Brighton was with a force of more than 16,000 that retreated from the capital, Kabul, and then were massacred or kidnapped by Afghan tribesmen as they fled. On this day in 1910, American inventor Lee DeForest broadcast a live performance of Enrico Caruso from the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. The broadcast could be heard only by a small number of electronics hobbyists, but by 1915, DeForest was broadcasting regular nightly concerts, increasing interest in the new communications medium, radio.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend.
And on this day in 1968, Johnny Cash gave a concert at Folsom State Prison in Northern California. The album recorded at the prison became a big hit in the United States and by 2003 had sold 3 million copies. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of Labor has awarded $10 million toward a cooperative agreement with an NGO to implement a project addressing exploitative labor among youth in Ethiopia. The effort, to be conducted with the group World Vision, aims to help vulnerable youth in Ethiopia develop the skills they need to make a successful transition into good jobs. We know when youth are provided skills training and career services that align with needs in the jobs market, they are less likely to be drawn into exploitative labor, Deputy Undersecretary of Labor for International Affairs Carol Pierce said in announcing the award. The project will promote education and vocational training opportunities and seek to enhance livelihoods and access to social protection programs for youth and their households, focusing specifically on the needs of girls. The project aims to address exploitative child labor by providing youth ages 14 to 17 with marketable skills and support to secure decent work. The project will also support President Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative. Since 1993, the ILAB has produced reports to raise awareness globally about child labor and forced labor. ILAB has also provided funding for more than 280 projects in more than 94 countries to combat the worst forms of child labor by providing assistance to vulnerable children and their families. Based in Washington State, World Vision is a nonprofit humanitarian organization conducting relief, development, and advocacy activities in its work with children, families, and their communities in nearly 100 countries to help them reach their full potential by tackling the causes of poverty and injustice. In its 2013 report on human rights practices, the U.S. Department of State noted that the lack of labor inspectors and controls prevented the Ethiopian government from enforcing the law. The resources for inspections and the implementation of penalties were extremely limited. This project builds on the successes of the Ethiopians Fighting Against Child Exploitation project that was also implemented by World Vision in 2011 to 2014.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.